You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection held its final hearing until September last night. We'll talk about the witness testimony around former President Trump's actions between public appearances while his supporters attacked the Capitol and where the committee goes next. Now, summer camping season is here. That means getting outside with people you love and great meals around the campfire. Not everybody's a seasoned camper or seasoned cook, and cooking over a campfire can be intimidating if you've never done it. Our Food Friday guest is a camp cooking pro. She's got advice and some recipes to help us get started. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What memories do you have of meals around the campfire? Memories from years ago or maybe last weekend? Do you have some go-to recipes for using the campfire? Does it sound like a lot of work to you? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ashley Rodriguez is a cookbook author, writer, and photographer. She's the co-creator of the Kitchen Unnecessary series about cooking outdoors, nominated for a James Beard Award. She's a nature and forest therapy guide. Ashley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here talking about something that I love so much.
What is it you love so much? Not just about camping, but about, you know, taking that effort and cooking using the campfire.
Well, no matter where I'm at, I want to be eating delicious food. And so when we started cooking and camping with our family, I wanted to kind of experiment and play around with cooking over the fire to see if I could bring that same delicious meal that I would cook at home in my kitchen and see if I could do it at the campfire and kind of elevate that food experience and go a little bit beyond, you know, just hot dogs over the fire, or what we also love to do, which is delicious, but we wanted to kind of elevate, you know, the potatoes and tinfoil, that kind of a thing. So I started playing around with it and bringing some more ingredients and just treating the campfire like my stove.
And I have maybe the wrong mindset here, because I came in thinking, oh, this sounds like a lot of work, a lot of trouble. No, you say, I mean, yes, it can be some work, but you actually really enjoy. You think there's something almost therapeutic, I think, about cooking around a campfire.
I absolutely do. And it is a little bit of work. And, you know, cooking is a bit of work. But the thing with cooking around the fire is that it's wild. It's a bit uncontrolled. And so it forces me to be present and to stay in the process, which is also what I love about being outside, is that it sort of just takes you out of your inbox and reprioritizes your to-do list and offers us some perspective. And cooking over the fire does that for me. I mean, we used to do that, right? This is what we knew how to do. And so it also connects to us in a way that feels really primal. There's something instinctual about cooking over the fire that I absolutely love.
When we're looking for recipes now, you shared some, we'll get to those in a bit, but in general, what are some of the keys, especially for the novice, to a successful campfire recipe?
Well, I like to have a bit of a plan. I do some of my prepping at home because, you know, it is a little bit more difficult when all you have maybe is a knife and a cutting board, if that. Maybe you're just cutting on a picnic table at the campsite. So I like to prep and plan ahead. I also, if we're going with a group, I like to kind of divvy it out. So you bring some chopped up vegetables. I might bring a dressing or some sauce that's already made ahead, so that what I'm doing is just cooking over the fire and assembling some of the things that we prepped ahead. But really, you can look at your campfire as you would an oven or a stove. There are just some things that you need to be aware of. And you also need to go into it knowing that perfection does not exist here. And that's okay. You know, I do love to bake bread over the fire. And more often than not, there's a big patch of it that's got a nice large charred spot. But there is still nothing better than homemade bread, especially when you're eating it sitting around the fire. So you have to kind of readjust your expectations, go in with a bit of a plan, and then allow for some space for creativity and, you know, allow the fire to do what it's going to do.
What are some of the key tools we want to pack along with us?
That's a great question. And I've kind of gotten this down now to a point where I just have a bin already loaded and packed and ready to go. So I have no resistance when the campfire is calling. So I keep a knife kit already packed and ready with just a very sharp knife, some long metal tongs. So this will help keep your hands free from the fire. I always have like a fireproof glove also that just, again, you're going to be very close to the fire. So you want to stay as safe as possible. I might bring a wooden spoon or a spatula, and that's pretty much it. I have, you know, some very basic seasonings. I bring a few pantry items with me, salt, pepper, some olive oil. I throw in a fresh lemon because you never know when you need a little acid in there, but I keep it really, really simple. I just went camping with a good friend of mine this weekend, and I raided my garden and just brought a ton of vegetables. We each brought a couple of cheeses and some lovely bread, and we picked up some oysters at a seafood market on the way, and grilled oysters and vegetables and cheese and bread, and we just had a delicious feast with the water as our background.
It's Food Friday. We are cooking around the campfire with Ashley Rodriguez, cookbook author, co-creator of the Kitchen Unnecessary series about cooking outdoors. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you like to cook around a campfire? Whether that campfire is in your backyard, at a campsite you drove up to, or maybe one you hiked a long way to get to. What are your favorite foods to eat around the campfire, fancy or simple? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ashley, you shared some recipes with us. They're online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's start. I think this is on the simple end here. Ember-cooked cheese. Great. This is Wisconsin. With rosemary ash. This is super easy and it looks super delicious. Tell us about it.
It's super easy and it sounds so fancy, right? It's literally taking a chunk of one of your favorite really nice melty cheeses, sticking it in a cast iron pan and heating it over the fire. Just to add a little bit more flavor and a little bit more excitement, I take some rosemary that I've brought from my garden, and I'll just stick it right on the coals until it gets this beautiful fragrant smoke, and that those charred leaves have a really lovely flavor. So I'll just crumble that right into the melty cheese. Invite your friends and family to head around the campfire with hunks of bread, and you just start dipping that into that melty cheese, and it is a really special experience.
What are some of your favorite cheeses to use for this?
I like I'm talking to Wisconsin here. So I just like something that is really nice and creamy and really melty. So a good cow's soft cheese that just can kind of puddle and melt. And if you're really lucky, get those crispy bits around the edges of the cast iron. That's the best part.
And now we'll advance our cast iron cookery a little bit with some pizza. We've got a pizza with mushrooms, speck, and arugula, but give us the basics. I'm guessing we're not mixing the dough and hand tossing it on the spot.
No, I actually love to bring my dough with me to the campsite. It's another one of those things. And to save some cooler space, sometimes I'll even freeze the dough and then it becomes another ice block. So I'm always trying to extend the life of my ice in my cooler. So this is a good way to do that. But I bring my dough already pre-mixed to the campsite, kind of roll it out or stretch it out by hand. This is when, if you can bring a cutting board or some kind of surface like that, it's really helpful. And then I heat my cast iron over the coals in the fire. And when it's nice and hot, I'll add a little bit of olive oil, put the dough right into the pan, let it cook for a few minutes, then carefully flip it over. And then that's when I'll add my toppings, my cheese, whatever you have on hand. If you're using some vegetables or mushrooms, things like that, you might want to saute those up a little bit first and then cook your dough and add it to the top. And it is so wonderful.
And that reminds me,
pizza around the fire, what's better than that?
It sounds great. And that reminds me of a key point here. Most of the cooking we're talking about, you're not holding a thing in the flames or over the flames. You're kind of using that bed of coals to be your heat source.
Exactly. That is such a good point. And that's something that I kind of had to figure out when I first started doing this. It's all about the coals. And so I do a lot of car camping. I'm not backpacking in with my cast iron and hardwood charcoal. Yeah. But I will often bring some hardwood charcoal to the campsite with me if your campsite allows it. But that way I can kind of preemptively get a nice hot bed of coals going. So you can start the fire with some softwood, but then you want to get a nice bed of hardwood coals. That's going to give you the nice elongated heat source for a really long time, but that's going to help you also control the temperature, and you're really going to be cooking with that. Otherwise, you know, you might get too much flames, too much smoke, too much really hot heat on your food. And so it kind of chars before it has a chance to cook. So get a nice bed of coals. If the fire pit is big enough, my favorite thing to do is to have some of the fire, you know, there's flames over here, but then you're moving the bed of coals into your cooking section. So you kind of create two different sections. You get the section that is always getting the coals ready for you. And then once those are ready, you move them over to your cooking section.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Laura is with us in Twin Lakes. Laura, hi.
Hi. I was calling about, I'm planning a trip to Bigfoot State Park in Lake Geneva next week, and I'm going to stay overnight and then walk around Lake Geneva. And what I really love is you have a campfire the night before, and early the next morning with the embers from the coals from the night before, you take your bread and toast it. It is incredible. You have to watch it very carefully, but you can make the most spectacular toast early in the morning with those coals left over.
Laura, thanks. Oh, go ahead.
That's one of the things I have to look forward to.
That's wonderful, Laura. Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yeah, I think I could pull off campfire toast, Ashley, even me.
Oh, absolutely. That's such a great idea. That's exactly what we had for breakfast on our camping trip this weekend. Brought some homemade jam and really, is there anything better than that?
Thanks for that call, Laura. We're talking to Ashley Rodriguez. She's a cookbook author, co-creator of the Kitchen Unnecessary series about cooking outdoors. She's with us on Food Friday during summer camping season to talk about meals you can make on and around the campfire. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite foods to eat cooked on or near the campfire, advanced or simple? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation. Maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk about meals you can make on your next camping trip. Ashley Rodriguez with Kitchen Unnecessary stays with us, and you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your memories, your questions, your favorite things to cook at the campfire. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go back to your calls. Tim is with us in Minnesota. Tim, hi.
Hey, I had two questions for Ashley. One was about how if you have to cook multiple foods at different temperatures, how you kind of manage that on the fire. And then the other question, Ashley, I was wondering if you've ever done any experimenting with cooking underground, like using coals or a fire, and then just using the dirt in the ground to kind of insulate and cook your food.
Oh, wow. Okay, two great questions, Tim. Thanks. First of all, when we need to cook things at two different temperatures, that can be a problem in the oven at home, too.
Yeah, absolutely. These are great questions. Thanks so much, Tim. Yeah, so again, like I said, if you have a big enough space, a big enough campfire, you can kind of create zones. And again, you're using the heat of the coals to adjust the temperature. So if you need things at different temperatures, you can have a spot that has a larger pile of coals, maybe has a bed underneath the pan and surrounding the pan. If you're using a Dutch oven, you're also using the heat of the coals on top of the lid. And then if you need something to cook a little bit slower, then you just move away some of those coals, maybe don't have any on the bottom of the pan, but just a couple that are a couple of inches away from the sides of it. So it's all about manipulating and moving around those coals that will control the heat for you. And as far as cooking things underground, that is something that I think it's such an absolutely cool technique. I've seen, you know, those just giant succulent pigs and things that they cook underground. And I think that is so cool. I have not done that, but I have done some like slow roasted beets under a bed of coals. And oh my gosh, ooh, a beet cooked in the fire. I promise you, it is a thing of beauty. So I've played around with some root vegetables, but that is one thing that I want to experiment with more.
Thanks for the call, Tim. John joins us now in Baldwin. Hi, John. John, hi, you're on the air. Go ahead. Oh, I guess. Go ahead. All right. Not getting John. Let's try Jackie now in Milwaukee. Jackie, hi.
Hi. What I really like is I take a loaf of crusty Italian bread with sesame seeds, four rolls, and I slice it in half, and I layer cheddar cheese, and then the diced green chilies from a can, and then pepper jack cheese. Put it together, tin foil, stick it on the fire about 10 minutes. It is heavenly.
Awesome, Jackie. That sounds great. And again, pretty easy, Ashley.
That sounds amazing. I'm going to write that down and save that for my next camping trip. Yeah, that sounds easy and so delicious.
And tin foil can definitely be a campfire cook's, or aluminum foil, I guess, technically, a campfire cook's best friend.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I mentioned earlier in the program, you know, that the kind of classic, what we used to call spit and chew. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but, you know, we used to do this as kids, just throw in a couple of carrots, potatoes, things like that. But I've elevated that a little bit and threw in some sausage, some apples and potatoes, some nice fresh herbs, salt, pepper, slowly cook that. And then right while it's still warm, throw in pieces of Gruyere cheese and serve it with some Dijon mustard or even a little mayonnaise and Dijon mustard. And it is delicious.
Thanks for that suggestion at 800-642-1234. Doug is with us now in Colfax. Doug, hello.
Hello. A couple of things that we do that we really like is to pre-mix scrambled eggs for breakfast. Put them in a container and, you know, already have veggies or whatever you want to put in with your scrambled eggs. And then you just dump it straight into the pan in a nice resealable container and you got a pretty quick breakfast.
Awesome, Doug. Thanks a lot for that. Ashley, any advice on egg cooking around the campfire?
No, that sounds like a great idea. Yeah, we like to do some eggs in the morning as well. Throw on some bacon. And yeah, that sounds great. I'm going to try that next time as well.
Doug, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Ashley Rodriguez is with us for Food Friday, cookbook author, co-creator of the Kitchen Unnecessary series, talking about cooking around the campfire. Let's check out another recipe you shared with us, Ashley. It's at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll get a little fancier here. Smoked clam carbonara. Wow. That sounds to me pretty ambitious. Is it?
It is not. It does sound ambitious, but pasta over the fire is also really, really good. You want to make sure that for this, you bring a steel or stainless steel pot with you to boil the water in, but the clams just slowly cook in the fire, and that's what give them that nice smoky flavor. And then it's really just a little bit of cheese you're making a sauce with some whipped up egg and cheese, and the heat from the pasta creates this really lovely sauce. The other thing that we like to do is campfire mac and cheese. And that you just start by sauteing some onions, or I love mushroom mac and cheese, and saute that in. Throw in your pasta into that pot and then cook it with the water in there. And then once the water is almost all absorbed and the pasta is still al dente, start stirring in your cheese. And it is so creamy and so satisfying. And that is a perfect recipe to make for a crowd.
Go back to our callers now. Andrew is with us in Minnesota. Andrew, hello.
Yeah, hey, how's everybody doing?
Good. What do you got for us, Andrew?
Yeah, so it can be cooked on a grill. Bruschetta, super simple. Take whatever bread you like, slice it, toast it on the fire so you get the extra points from the smokiness there as far as flavor is concerned. After it is toasted, you take a raw clove of garlic. You use the bread to grate the garlic onto the bread. So you're just talking about just a little bit. Otherwise, you can get fairly garlicky. Tomatoes, onions, basil all travels real well in a cooler. Chop that all fresh. Put that onto your now garlic toast that is smoky from the campfire. And you are promised a very good time.
Andrew, thanks a lot. Bruschetta, basically, on the campfire. I love it.
Yeah, it sounds like I got some new friends to go camping with. This sounds delicious.
Definitely. Now, Ashley, getting a little more advanced here, we got one more recipe to share here. Ooh, this one sounds good too. Roasted pumpkin fondue with chanterelles, those mushrooms, and chorizo. Now, we grow good pumpkins here in Wisconsin, and we can get some good mushrooms too.
Yeah, this is perfect. This one is over the top, but I'm telling you, you got to try it once. So, I mean, you could do just fondue over the campfire. And we mentioned that with that block of cheese, and you could just melt it that way. But this turns the vessel that you're cooking the fondue into it's edible as well. And so you start by roasting the pumpkin in the coals themselves. And then when that starts to get tender, then you turn that into the cooking vessel. You add a little white wine, throw in some cheese until it's nice and melty. And then in another pot, you saute up some mushrooms, chorizo, add that to the melty cheese. And again, you are just sitting around the fire, dipping bread into melty, mushroomy, pumpkin-y cheese. And especially in the fall when it's just starting to kind of get cool in the evenings. Oh, this is really an amazing meal.
That sounds great. Again, find that at WPR.org/Food Friday. Ashley, you know, one thing that's striking me, cast iron skillets, you know, sometimes we have trouble maintaining them in the comfort of our own kitchen. How do you keep your cast iron skillet, you know, clean and not having, you know, globs of cheese forever burned onto it?
Yeah, well, I've been working on seasoning mine for a number of years now, so she's been treating me well. But here's the other thing. If you are the campfire cook, then you shouldn't be doing the dishes. So we've got it worked out. So when we go camping, I'll do the cooking, but I'm not going to be doing the dishes. So I let other people deal with that.
That sounds great. What are you, now you mentioned you just had a camping trip. I imagine you've got maybe more in the works. What is in your head for like, okay, you want to experiment with this around a campfire sometime?
Yeah, well, one thing I just did recently that was so wonderful is just really simple grilled oysters. And I brought with me a compound butter. I mixed butter with minced shallots, some hot sauce, some red wine vinegar, and plenty of cracked black pepper. And once the oysters popped open, I took off one of the shells, put some of that butter in, and grilled it until it was all bubbly and delicious. The other thing that I want to try is want to go out and get some fresh crab. We live right here by the water, and do some fire cooked crab over the fire while we're camping. I think that would be really delicious as well.
Sounds fantastic. Ashley, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much. This has been so fun, and now I'm hungry.
Me too. That's Ashley Rodriguez, cookbook author, photographer, co-creator of the Kitchen Unnecessary series. Join us on Food Friday for some campfire cooking. Find those recipes again at WPR.org/Food Friday. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection held another primetime hearing last night. The focus, what then-President Donald Trump heard, said, did, and didn't do in the hours on January 6th following his speech to supporters at the Ellipse. It was the eighth in a series of hearings by the committee. We learned that this will be the last one until they resume in September. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you watched or listened to this latest hearing, what stood out to you most? What questions do you have about it? If you're not watching them, are you following this in general? What do you think? Has this changed your mind in any way? Call 800-642-1234. And what do you want the outcome of all of this to be? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Alyssa Von Hagel is professor of political science and the gender studies program coordinator at UW Superior. Alyssa, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Before we dive into the details, Alyssa, big picture. I don't usually like to use the word unprecedented, but we have an unprecedented thing going on in American elections, a sitting president losing the election, saying he didn't lose the election, going through a wide variety of efforts to, I guess, unlose it. Can you talk about this unique moment in American history that this committee is trying to capture?
Absolutely. I mean, you're spot on that this is truly, like, you know, unprecedented. In our history, there's so much complexity surrounding all of the various aspects of it. So that adds to the remarkable nature of it all. But some point to the special hearings that were held, the Watergate hearings, when right before Nixon had resigned from office. But even then, they were very distinct hearings. And in that case, there was bipartisanship towards the end. Republicans convinced Nixon to resign. So the way that all of this is kind of unfolded has truly been a truly unprecedented point in American history.
And what stood out to you now from last night's hearing?
Well, there's a number of, you know, every hearing there's new, seems bombs dropped, or perhaps that's not the proper way to say it. But there was, I think that, so there's two new witnesses that came forward. Both witnesses were White House employees who resigned that day of January 6th after what had happened. And they added more, you know, details and explanation as to what was going on in the White House. I think that what to me stood out is, well, there's many things that stood out, of course, but what to me stood out as one of the most remarkable aspects of the day is that for the, you know, for 3 to 4 hours, there was absolutely no contact from the sitting president, Donald Trump, to any law enforcement, military leadership at all, whereas that call essentially came from Pence, from Vice President Pence. And so, you know, that to me is truly striking that the sitting president, you know, seeing this unfold over hours and hours, took no steps to, you know, to deal with it, essentially. And it was the vice president who was making the calls, trying to, you know, have law enforcement respond to the actions at the Capitol.
We're talking to Alisa von Hagel, professor of political science at UW-Superior, looking at last night's hearing of the January 6th House Committee. You can join in with your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You just mentioned former Vice President Pence. We learned a little more about the situation he and his security detail faced in the Capitol on January 6th of 2021. This is from a White House security official. Note here that the audio was altered. This is an anonymous official altered the audio here to protect the official's identity. Here's a listen.
The members of the VP detail at this time were starting to fear for their own lives. There was a lot of yelling, a lot of very personal calls over the radio. So it was disturbing. I don't like talking about it, but there were calls to say goodbye to family members, so on and so forth. It was getting, for whatever the reason was on the ground, the VP detail thought that this was about to get very ugly.
And this, of course, we know they're part of the group of people in the Capitol were chanting, "Hang Mike Pence." This particular audio suggesting that his security detail was fearing the worst at this point.
Absolutely. And that, I mean, I think this far out from the actual events that transpired, we kind of lose that memory of just the abject fear that so many people were facing and the violence that was taking place. And this is another reminder of, you know, how fearful and how violent, you know, it was, the events were at the Capitol at this time. And truly it's, you know, horrific to think of, you know, the Secret Service agents or, you know, whether it's members of Congress, their staff, were in similar precarious situations as well.
And the committee definitely emphasized what the president tweeted and when, and making the point that as the former vice president and his detail were facing this risk, President Trump had essentially tweeted that Pence was a coward, didn't have the courage to invent this power to stop the election. Do you see this committee trying to establish, I guess, culpability for the former president, whether in a legal sense or at least in a political sense?
I think with respect to the issue of Trump's response to the, you know, the chance of hang Mike Pence and his complacency with and even seemingly support of that, those chants and potentially action, I think it's more of a political issue that, you know, necessarily as a compared to a legalistic question. But certainly I think, you know, it should, you know, be a perhaps also an, you know, perhaps an ethical or moral, you know, issue as well, that in terms of his, you know, support or at the very least complacency for, you know, listening to, hearing this and again, doing nothing in response to this.
Part of the question here has been on January 6th, you know, to what extent was this just a protest that got out of hand versus part of a wider effort to block the outcome of the election? At the very end, the committee played audio from former Trump advisor Steve Bannon, convicted earlier today on misdemeanor charges of contempt for Congress, appeal expected there. But Mother Jones, the magazine, released some tape of him on October 31st, 2020. This is before Election Day, laying out to some people he worked with a roadmap for Trump and the election results. Here's what the House committee played last night.
And what Trump's going to do is just declare victory, right? He's going to declare victory. But that doesn't mean he's the winner. He's just going to say he's the winner.
The Democrats, more of our people vote early that count. Theirs voted mail. And so they're going to have a natural disadvantage, and Trump's going to take advantage of it. That's our strategy. He's going to declare himself a winner. So when you wake up Wednesday morning, it's going to be a firestorm.
And he went on in more detail about how chaotic things could get in that scenario. So even before the election, this idea that there will be no accepting of an election loss. How does that fit into this wider narrative?
I mean, I think his predictions that were found in that recording, I mean, virtually all of them came to pass. They came true, essentially. And yes, as you mentioned, he mentioned revolution. He mentioned violence of, you know, whether or not, you know, if it the violence will come sooner rather than later, if it will come, you know, immediately upon, you know, the day after the election or January 6th, that he repeatedly made reference to this notion of violence. And so I think, again, it shows that there is, you know, at some levels, at least among some of his allies had foreknowledge or believed that January 6th would very well become a day of violence. And certainly that is, you know, again, proving that Trump was aware of or part of these schemes is, you know, another like totally different legal question. However, the fact that there were White House allies, individuals talking about this well ahead of time is deeply concerning.
We're talking right now about last night's hearing of the January 6th committee. UW Superior Political Science Professor Alisa von Hagel stays with us. And you could join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Did you watch or listen to last night's hearing or catch up this morning? Have you been following these? Does watching make for a different experience, do you think? What do you hope is the outcome of all of this, if anything? Do you want to see charges filed? If so, against whom? Or do you want to see these done? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Alisa von Hagel, political science professor at UW Superior, looking at last night's hearing of the January 6th committee. You could join in with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. What stood out to you last night? Are you following these things? Are you hoping that there is some kind of outcome, whether legal or a message that reaches the American people? If so, which ones? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring out a caller now. Jane is with us in Eau Claire. Jane, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Jane?
Oh, just that I've talked to several people who felt like they didn't want to get too emotionally involved in these hearings because they feel like we'll go through all of this, we'll have good evidence, and then nothing's going to happen at the end. So that's very frustrating. But as I watch it, I think Trump and Rudy Giuliani and several of them should be brought up on charges.
Jane, thanks for the call. Alisa, Jane, hope something comes out of this, it sounds like, worried that it won't. What do you think?
Well, that actually falls in line with a poll that was just taken this past week, and with the majority of Americans finding that they do wish or do want charges to be brought in this particular instance, but only 28% believe that it actually will happen. So I think that feeling is in line with many Americans right now. And again, also the Department of Justice has been very slow moving and even investigating top officials or the former president. And so it does seem that as if, you know, for some people, it has been argued that, you know, some have argued that they seem to be sort of dragging their feet or not wanting to pursue legal charges against these individuals. However, again, they obviously still have time to do so. And with the things that have been uncovered over these hearings so far, there is increasing pressure to do so. So who knows, we may see some movement in the future, but certainly that is a very common concern. Amongst so many Americans.
That's on the legal side. Now, here's Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming appealing in her remarks a political outreach, I think, to perhaps some of President Trump's supporters. This is from her remarks yesterday.
Here's the worst part. Donald Trump knows that millions of Americans who supported him would stand up and defend our nation were it threatened. They would put their lives and their freedom at stake to protect her. And he is preying on their patriotism. He is preying on their sense of justice. And on January 6th, Donald Trump turned their love of country into a weapon against our capital and our Constitution.
What, Elisa, do you think of that that rhetoric directed, I think, at President Trump's supporters in this case?
All right, and I think that she is correct. And I would also add that, you know, anything that has come up in these hearings, the bombshells that have been dropped from, you know, numerous different individuals testifying, that there's a core group of Trump supporters that still do not waver at all with their support of the president. Certainly he does not have anywhere near a majority of support amongst Americans overall. And amongst Republicans, his support is declining. However, again, there are those, that core group of supporters where their support for him will not waver seemingly regardless of what comes up. And so it's, you know, whether or not that group of individuals can be reached or can be you know, this can be discussed with, I think is at this point perhaps not the best political route to go. But certainly there has been perhaps some shift in the Republican Party among some individuals.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. Yes. So I liken this whole thing to a boater being out in front of a beach in Southern California, chumming the water. And they're throwing all kinds of chum in the water, and the sharks come in, and they attack the swimmers, and a few of the swimmers die, and others get bit. Not all the, this whole thing, what Trump did and all his allies, to me, reminds me of just that sort of scenario. Boater out there, chum in the water, and for anything that happened. I'd love to see Bannon in jail and most of Trump's henchmen, and I wouldn't lose any sleep if Trump himself spent some time in jail.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Elisa, members of the committee definitely try to connect the dots to what President Trump said, did, and then didn't do on the afternoon of the 6th to the violent outcomes, as our caller says, like throwing chum in the water.
Absolutely, and I think even the efforts that the committee made to emphasize that Trump was repeatedly told by aides, by top level officials, by his family members that there was no voter fraud, that he lost the election, that, you know, trying to, you know, tell him, impart upon him, you know, that this claim of voter fraud is simply not true. However, with the Steve Bannon release of the Steve Bannon tape, or reviewing it now in this particular context, it seems as if that was sort of part of the strategy as well. And so I think the calls for violence is part of that, as the caller mentioned, the sort of chumming the waters, but certainly even just the emphasis on the voter fraud that continued from the day after the election through, well, even till today, is also part of that same activity.
We're talking to political scientist Elisa von Hagel from UW-Superior, looking at yesterday's January 6th House committee hearing. Back to your calls. Larry is with us now in Onalaska. Larry, hi.
Hi. Since the maybe the George W. Bush administration, we've had a situation which has been clearly demonstrated in these hearings of people in roles of leadership who are consciously and purposefully lying and misleading the public to their own ends. And we still have apparently a significant portion of the population knowing that these people are lying, knowing that these people have lied and have consciously attempted to manipulate them, but because whatever causes or programs they endorse are consistent with the views of those voters, they'll still vote for these people. And so these people stay in office, they stay in roles of leadership. I just wonder if the whole society is not being corrupted by the fact that we're consciously encouraging people to be dishonest.
Larry, thanks for the call. At least a big picture, Larry's worried about the corruption of our government, of our society, based on misinformation.
Absolutely, and I think that is a major issue today, especially with so many issues, not just this, of course, but issues related to climate change and the role of science and policymaking and the distrust or non-belief in, you know, scientific studies, or whether it's vaccines or climate or what have you. And so I think that this is a very critical and crucial issue for the U.S. and the world in general. But specifically, it also pertains to this issue as well, where the truth doesn't really seem to matter. The facts are your facts, but they're not my facts, you know, so to speak. So I think it is a very, very crucial issue. And it's not something that's easily fixed or changed in terms of, trying to encourage, the proper channels to find, to trust with respect to scientific information, or just simple claims of information from public officials. So absolutely, it's a very critical issue that we need to address.
Larry, thanks for that call. I want to look ahead now. This committee is on break through August, but they're planning to come back in September. And here's Representative Liz Cheney kind of foreshadowing what's coming up.
Efforts to litigate and overcome immunity and executive privilege claims have been successful, and those continue. Doors have opened, new subpoenas have been issued, and the dam has begun to break. And now, even as we conduct our ninth hearing, we have considerably more to do. We have far more evidence to share with the American people and more to gather. So our committee will spend August pursuing emerging information on multiple fronts before convening further hearings this September.
Now, of course, we don't know what they have now and what they'll be working on over the next month. But Elisa, what questions are on your mind that you think could be addressed in future hearings?
I think many of the individuals that have not yet testified and have been subpoenaed, some of whom have been held in contempt, perhaps they may have, they may be able to have some of these individuals come in for closed depositions to get information from them. So that might be a critical part of the piece of the, larger puzzle. There's a number of, I believe, 5 or 6 members of Congress that have been subpoenaed and have refused to participate. And so, again, perhaps, there might be some involvement either of them or aides that may lead to, new avenues or new information that was just simply previously unknown as this point.
Elisa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Elisa von Hagel, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin Superior. She talked with us today about the House January 6th committee's last hearing until September, that hearing in prime time last night. You can still share your thoughts, email ideas at WPR.org, and follow coverage of everything, all political news at WPR.org. We'll have coverage of state news, and we provide coverage from NPR as well at WPR.org. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, Congress is working on a Respect for Marriage bill aimed at protecting same-sex marriage in the event of a Supreme Court reversal of past rulings on the issue. We're going to take a look at the proposal and what it could change, and you can join in and tell us what you want to see Wisconsin senators do. They've both been talking about that issue in the news. Plus, we'll find out why women of color may face some of the biggest consequences of the end of Roe v. Wade after that U.S. Supreme Court ruling, and abortion bans kicking in Wisconsin and elsewhere. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.